Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Thanks for listening to the New Statesman podcast, a New Statesman Network show. Why not try one of our other podcasts, like Skylines, the City Metric podcast all about the workings of cities, hosted by John L. Edge. Find out more and subscribe at citymetric.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
This week,
we discuss how the Tory party has apparently gone mad over a leadership battle.
We go mad over the new Doctor Who.
And we interview Johnny Reynolds from Labour's finance front bench about the budget. Stephen, do we have to talk about Brexit?
Yes, we will have to continue to talk about Brexit for the rest of our natural lives.
I mean, you did predict this in 2016, to be fair to you. So I think if anyone deserves any credit out of this mess, it should be you. You're like, this is our national project for the next 10 years. How we laughed in early 2016.
Well, it's odd because the thing obviously every year I do an audit of not just things I've got wrong in that year, but things that that year has shown to have been got wrong than I said earlier. And one of the weird things is although there has been economic damage, it's been slower. The weird thing is I did kind of think by this point there would be more political awareness among MPs than Brexit was not like a one and done.
Not like a bill that you get through and it always like the health and social care reform and you kind of go, well, that was a bit juicy, but thank God that 900 page bill is through now.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they still haven't finished all the papers for no deal preparation, have they? In fact, they've done they've done less than 100 out of more than 1,000. This is the thing. You and I were talking about this earlier in terms of your column stuff. The reporting this week has been heavily around, I'm going to get the number wrong, 48 letters have got to go into Graham Brady, who's the chair of the 1922 committee. And there's been some beefing on Twitter, like Robert Peston says that someone's told him that every time Graham Brady sees people, he keeps going, oh, don't put the letters in yet, as if he's really close. And then Sam Coates of the Times says, well, I'd just not actually been able to stand that up with anybody who's actually firsthand had that experience. But what's happened inevitably is that Brexit, a huge, massive public policy challenge, a huge economic event, has, as it did all the way through the referendum campaign, been boiled down to Tory beefing. And I find this absolutely appalling. And I worry about how, as political journalists, we can offset it. Because to put it really crudely, on the day after we leave, if there is no deal, no transition deal even in place, right? That is technically a possibility. It is not going to matter whether it is David Davis or Theresa May in Downing Street if diabetics can't get their insulin, if people are, you know, looking at empty supermarket shelves. Which Conservative leader was currently holding the parcel when the music stops is mildly interesting, but it's one of those things that's easier to worry about if you've definitely got food and medicine.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? The important numbers in politics at the moment are not 48 or 150, whatever it is, then we'd have to get to, you know, survive a confidence vote within the Conservative Party. They are 29th of March 2019 and 7, the number of net Tory rebels you have to have for it not to pass, something which at the moment it looks certain you would have. But also, yeah, there are many fine things I don't understand about Theresa May, but the latest thing I don't understand about her, right, isn't this is someone who won't even bring herself to say, I think Brexit is a good idea, right? Who has nonetheless stood up and made a series of promises that she must know cannot be reconciled with us not having a disruptive and destructive exit. What does she think her... This is what I find fascinating about this whole kind of theatre of, oh, it's an implementation period. It's not an implementation period.
Nothing will be implemented. We
may have to have an implementation period at the end of. I'm just continually fascinated as to what her sense of what she thinks she's accomplishing by standing up, effectively lying to everyone, right? Now, yeah, there are lots of people in the Conservative Party who are high on their own supply and are saying things and are frankly delusional. However, it's also hard... Yeah, I mean, no seriously. Like,
give me an example.
I mean, the whole kind of weird thing of just like, well, you know, what are we getting in exchange for this transition? It's just like the transition, it's, but also one, the transition is good for, like the problem of Article 50, if you are the departing nation, is you are the victim of the ticking clock. Transition, particularly limitless transition, is good for you if you are the departing nation because it ends
it protects
the ability
your
of,
economic right, of, status, right, while you have time to sort out the details.
Yeah, this is the thing is then, the EU can continually go, here's the cliff edge, here's our deal, what's it going to be? So it is just bonkers, right? It is regardless of your position on Remain versus Leave, the position and transition and the ability to extend that transition is bad for the departing nation, is the politics of people who are simply not across the detail and should not be lawmakers, right? Like that, like we are talking about basic issues of competence here. But equally, when has Theresa May ever tried to articulate or explain that to anyone? The answer is she hasn't. She, you know, does everything in this kind of secretive, trusted circles. Here's my idea, take it or leave it. And then says, you know, a bunch of things which are, I mean, I don't think that austerity economics works, but
my God, did they explain it over and over again.
But I also think that ultimately they did think it was a good idea, right? Whereas Theresa May knows that it is not an implementation period. She's just creating huge problems for everyone else in the country, right? Ultimately, if there is a no deal, she will be fine.
Not if we burn her in a giant wicker man, she won't. Okay. I'm not advocating that. And as I do not advocate, I'd better not say that really, given that all those mad briefings at the weekend about people wanting to stab her. What is that about? Have they all gone? I mean, I think, you know, I hope it's okay to joke about burning Theresa May and a giant wicker man in the event of no deal, because that's a ludicrous, hyperbolic thing to say. But some of this was really quite properly nasty about how she should bring a noose to the committee room, all right?
Yeah, I mean, so I think now, obviously, I do not know who the source of those briefings were, but there are basically only three or four people I think could semi-plausibly be. Although Tim Shipman has denied that it is Andrew Bridgen. Lots of the sort of people around David Davis love their kind of military, yeah, that whole kind of like, you know, his whole kind of, needless to say, I had the last laugh, I was an XSA, you know, like, it would have been over in five rounds. Yeah, like, yeah, that kind of sort of...
Like the guy from, you know, the guy from Space who tries to join Rough Ramblers. Nick Frost character from Space, and then he gets very upset and goes, Rough Ramblers wouldn't have me, because he wants to crawl through the undergrowth with a knife in his teeth, in the same way that David Davis, I think, has succumbs to that desire sometimes. I find it very, very odd, but then I kind of almost see it as a kind of morbid symptom. I think they're all kind of part of the same thing, which is a party that has kind of lost the run of itself, right? They're just panicking, screaming, and I think there's almost a kind of feeling of, oh my God, it's all going to be a disaster, so we might as well play the kind of, you know, play the violin on the deck of the Titanic.
Yeah, I think the fascinating thing is, although I'm not someone who subscribes to the Yvette Cooper, Andy Burnham, Liz Kendall would be 20 points ahead thesis, I am continually fascinated about the fact that this is a party which does genuinely fear a Corbyn victory, and this is the level of not together they are. I continually ask myself, what would the Conservative Party be like if they were mildly peeved at the identity of the Labour leader, right? What, you know, this is...
Yeah, you know, they regard him as an existential threat, yet at the same time, yeah, they're like, hey, but maybe we should make him, by, you know, contrast with us, look actually quite sane and reasonable and middle of the road.
I think the question I can never settle in my head is, yeah, one Conservative MP put this well, they said, well, the problem is that everyone around here, this was a Conservative early conference, is terrified by a Jeremy Corbyn government, but they also can't really believe it will happen. And so the flip side is, would they actually be more cogent and together if it was someone that they regarded as more plausible?
But that's sort of the problem with no deal Brexit as well, right? Everybody is terrified of a no deal Brexit, but also no one, I think you wrote this in The Independent, no one really believes that anything that bad could happen. There's a kind of complacency
about
it.
My control ship forces me to say that it was The Eye, which is now a separate publication from The Independent with its interesting online footprint.
And excellent investment from some people in Saudi Arabia, entirely unproblematically. Well, we'll be coming back for a special budget edition of the podcast on Monday.
That's as in about the budget. All of these editions are special budget editions.
It'll be in an even smaller cupboard. But yeah, and I'm sure Brexit will come up, let's be honest.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome to the podcast, I was going to say podcast catacomb, but it is now the podcast cupboard. Johnny Reynolds, Shadow Economic Secretary to the Treasury and father, I think, of the four most photogenic children of any MP, which who feature often on your Christmas cards. And no, I was
that's down to their mum very much.
That is a good looking family, I think. You're here to talk about the budget, which is coming up next week. So I hear austerity is over. How's that working out?
Yes, well, I think that is obviously the story of the budget in terms of what maybe the Chancellor didn't want the budget to be framed as, but what the Prime Minister has said it will be framed as. The test is clearly going to be what level of action from the Chancellor can justify a claim as big as that. And I think to be as conservative, small-c conservative, as possible about it, you'd look at two things. You'd look at whether the scheduled spending cuts to departments will still go ahead up until the end of this spending period. And I think whether the cuts to welfare will proceed and the much publicised problems with universal credit will continue. And to do both of those things, to end those departmental spending cuts, you're looking at around £19 billion the Chancellor would have to find. And to do the welfare cuts, to not proceed with them, you'd look at another £7 billion. So if you add that on top of what has already been trailed in terms of perhaps the amount of money going into the NHS, which the Prime Minister wants to see, it's really quite a lot. And given that the Chancellor has found it very hard to raise taxation at all in his previous budget, it is, I think, quite hard to look at it and say with any confidence that austerity really will end next Monday.
So the extra money for the NHS is to fulfil the idea of the bus pledge, really. How much do you think the Conservative Party will try and sell any kind of turning on of money taps as a kind of Brexit dividend?
I think realistically, they know that simply isn't possible, certainly not possible until the early 2020s, if indeed that is true at all. I think the argument we will see instead of that is maybe an argument that says, look, since 2010, there's been a lot of pain, but because of that pain, you, the hardworking British public, have earned yourselves the right to end austerity. And I think for any of us who were there in 2010 and saw that emergency budget and listened to the claims that were made about that, you know, the AAA rating had to be retained at all costs, that there was no way you could even dream of a deficit extending beyond 2015, you know, that is incredibly hollow. And the state of the public services and the public finances generally, I would say, strongly prove that that course of action in 2010 was not the right one.
So, yeah, question. I want you to kind of a role play thing for me. Imagine that you are a Conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer. This is your opportunity to set economic dividing lines. I think basically almost everyone other than Theresa May, including Philip Hammond, agrees that the ending austerity dividing line is not a comfortable one for a government which is certainly not going to do that. What do you think, what would you do given their weird fiscal envelope? What would you do if you were a Conservative? What's the thing that if you stood up, you'd go, oh God, I wish you hadn't done that?
It's a tantalising thought experiment to be Philip Hammond for the day. One thing that Hammond has been very keen on is to try and essentially reverse, I would say, some of the damage done by George Osborne with those early cuts to capital investment. He's, you know, trumpeted in previous fiscal statements the amount of money that he's putting in. Whether that's a good dividing line with Labour, I would think probably not. I don't think he will ever match the level of spending that we would like to see, which we generally think is justified in terms of that investment going in. He's also been very reticent to essentially take any macroeconomic responsibility for things like the productivity problem. He's tried to push that down onto firms, which I think is a mistake. I think you've got to recognise this is a widely acknowledged British problem in the economy, and you'd expect the Chancellor to have something to say about it, other than we'd like firms to look at this and come up with some decent plans.
What's your analysis for why we've got a productivity problem?
There are many things that add up to a bigger problem. Certainly, we have more people in the labour market in the UK than comparable European countries, so there is some justification to say it's not a direct like-for-like comparison. An economy like ours, which is much more heavily skewed towards services than manufacturing, it is, broadly speaking, harder to bring about the productivity gains that you would get if you were investing in sort of new machinery and plants and automation and that sort of thing. But there's a particular British problem with productivity that's been a long-running thing, and no one, to be honest, has all the answers to it. But certainly, I would say anyone who's experienced that the joys of, say, the public transport system around my constituency getting between Leeds and Manchester, two really big economic drivers of the British economy. You know, the state of the railways, the quality of the roads, the delays you get. You can really see how strong investment in transport outside the southeast would actually really help with some of those productivity problems. And I think, again, that is widely acknowledged, but the delivery from the government just never matches the rhetoric.
So to go back to Stephen's question then, what is the thing you most fear Philip Hammond standing up and saying?
I don't think there's anything particularly that we fear, because I would certainly say the arguments around the economy are moving very much towards Labour in terms of the need for investment, the need for a Brexit deal which leaves the EU but doesn't damage jobs and growth at the same time. And broadly speaking, outside of the Labour movement, there is a growing consensus that there needs to be some quite severe interventions in the British economy. All of the work from the IPPR and Justin Welby fronting up some of that work. I think that case is growing, and I find it interesting to see how the Chancellor will respond to that. They will probably just go back to their greatest hits and start talking instead about, the amount of money Labour would spend, or massively conflate our ambitions and our spending figures. That tends to be the standard level of attack, because obviously what we can't have from them now is the Osborne claim that, frankly, austerity is the only way forward and, the country simply can't afford to do anything else.
In terms of the Labour movement, there are two exceptions to Britain's low productivity problem. The first is the last Labour government did slightly increase our productivity. The other, kind of in an odd way, more intriguing one is during the three-day week, when productivity went up.
Yeah.
The TUC has talked about moving towards a four-day week. You are one of the politicians who often sort of flirts with kind of new policy interventions. How do you feel about the idea of a four-day week?
I think it's a conversation worth having in terms of what you believe the long-term picture will look like in terms of how, technology and the world of work and what exactly is work in a modern economy changes. I don't think it's a sort of practical political proposal you'd be discussing round about a budget. I mean, productivity did rise in the three-day week. Unfortunately, output also declined very severely. And I think people have to understand that if you're not going to have a five-day working week, you have to find a way to make sure that the output of the economy is broadly the same if you're going to work less days than that. And I think even if, for instance, a four-day week produced the current output from 4.5 days of work, that's still a massive decline in the size of the national economy. And to fill that gap would require some awesome gains in productivity and the kinds of success that we've not enjoyed so far. So it's a conversation, I think, that is worth having, but it's not yet in the realm of practical politics.
Do you think there is a fundamental problem that we are still in a world of work where it is possible to work a full-time job and not therefore end up at the end of the week with enough money to be able to afford a basic standard of living? Right? That was the problem that tax credits were kind of brought in to solve. It's one that absolutely persists. Or is that something that we just have to fundamentally accept? Or is there a radical fundamental way to challenge that?
Well, it's certainly the case, and certainly not something that we should accept. I mean, there are two ways you address that. First of all, you need to boost wages, and wages today are in real terms lower than they were in 2010. So still, the recovery from the financial crisis has been incredibly slow. And that goes back to those points around, has austerity worked? Well, from the point of view of recovering from that big crisis, not really in terms of people's wages. But at the same time, you've got to look at, what are people's outgoings? What is the cost of food? What is the cost of energy? What's the cost of transport? And there are things that government can do to reduce those things as well. But the driver, and I address a lot of business audiences for the Labour front bench, for our of dialogue and our messages. And I say, I know what businesses want is more stability and less political volatility. But you've got to look at what the drivers of that volatility are. And at the minute, it is still that a lot of people's lives in this country are very, very difficult.
And one of the things, presumably, it also is causing a huge amount of worry from business is Brexit. I mean, you talked about the idea of a Brexit that protects jobs, that protects the economy. What economists are there who think that such a Brexit exists, that there is a form of Brexit that won't in any way damage the economy, at least in the short term?
Well, in terms of people who say there'll be no impact, I think that would be a relatively small group of people who are, you know, the ones very much attached to the ERG and the Conservatives who want a hard Brexit. Certainly there are ways you can manage Brexit that mitigate the damage to the economy. And for us on the Labour front bench, it's a simple cost-benefit analysis. If you could say the UK will be better off by, you know, decoupling itself from Europe, from seeking the autonomy that gets you free trade deals around the world, if that would objectively look to us like the better way forward, I think people would listen to that case, but it simply isn't. I mean, if you, people talking about joining, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and things like that, we do more trade with Germany than all of those countries combined. So certainly if you're leaving the political side of Europe, what you should be seeking, in our view, is a relationship with the European Union that mitigates the damage to the economy and therefore gives you a chance to negotiate some of the things that you'd want that deal to continue. Market access for financial services, no disruption to manufacturing supply chains. And of course, at the same time, you've got the political challenge of Northern Ireland to solve. I think it's pretty obvious what the deal should look like and what it should be. But at the minute, that's not something the government are willing to listen to.
In terms of what the deal looks like for the government, as you've sort of alluded to, one of the things you have to do is go around talking to business and doing sort of reassurance thing. The thing lots of banks don't like is the idea of becoming rule takers within the single market. However, given that so much of the driver, including in seats like yours, was borders, money and laws, can that possibly be reconciled?
Well, it depends on which bit of the city you're talking to in terms of whether the rule taker issue is the biggest issue. For, you know, a large US investment bank, it's really not the issue. They just want somewhere to land in the single market, and the UK is the most competitive and best place in their view to do that from. For sectors like insurance, it's a much bigger issue. It really is, and will undoubtedly affect, you know, how much business is done and located in the UK going forward. But you can't square the circle of that problem unless you're willing to be a member of the EU, and that is clearly not the mandate of the referendum. So you've got to take, you know, some trade-offs to that deal. One of the frustrations I think a lot of people have with the Chequers deal, even if it is a deal that can be done or a deal the Conservative Party will vote for, it tries to fudge that issue. It tries to say you can be entirely aligned with Europe and get the benefits of all that frictionless trade and lovely market access. But then it says you can also seek free trade deals around the world and you've got no issues in terms of being a rule taker. That's just not realistic. You know, there are trade-offs that have to be addressed in terms of that final deal. And for us, we have to acknowledge, to a certain degree, whether we are seeking a sort of a remote relationship to Europe or quite a close one to it, the EU is going to set the regulatory standards for the single market that we export the vast majority of our goods to. I'm afraid if we're leaving the EU as we are, we're going to have our say in those rules limited. And frankly, whether it's through a sort of formal arrangement or frankly, just the reality of selling goods to the single market, there'll be an element of accepting the rules and regulations that exist there.
Okay, assume that there is, for some reason, and I can't believe I'm even saying this, a snap election on Friday that Labour wins, and actually it would be, therefore, John McDonnell standing up on Monday. What would he do differently? What are Labour's economic priorities at the moment?
Well, I think there's two things you'd immediately look to. First of all, it would be that genuine ending of austerity, so the kind of, I would say, fairly reasonable tax rises that were contained in the manifesto to fund a greater degree of day-to-day spending. But then also a raft of policies designed to address the kind of economic problems which the Conservative Party agree with but haven't really got answers to. So we have things like in the manifesto, the National Investment Bank designed to drive up investment in the regions but also lending to business, trying to address some of those issues of regional inequality. You've got things like a much greater set of trade union rights. So from day one, people are going to have the ability in their own workplaces to argue for a different set of paying conditions to what they have at the minute. So it's not just about spending. This argument we'll have on Monday is not just about who would spend more, how would they spend that money. It's also about the wider set of solutions to the economic problems of the country, which are widely agreed upon, but you know, the answers are strongly disputed.
It feels like Labour is tiptoeing towards saying that universal credit is not only a failed policy, but one that you would essentially end the rollout of, roll back to some extent. That would be a huge spending commitment. Where on earth would you think that you get that money from?
Well, I would argue that it's not quite the the huge spending commitment, if that were the way forward that you might think it is. I mean, clearly, there are two problems with universal credit. One is its design and the speed of implementation that the government was seeking to do. The second one is a whole range of cuts to in-work benefits were piled into it. Every time there was a U-turn under Osborne, he never really U-turned, he just deferred it into the rollout of universal credit. So I think going back to the situation before Osborne tried to do that, it is not an unreasonable position if that is what we eventually get to. But I mean, we've had universal credit in my constituency for quite some time. We were one of the pathfinder areas, and it has fundamentally affected how I see the welfare state and how I see, you know, the kinds of policies that government pursue.
Tell me more about that. What do you mean in terms of what people are coming? Are people coming to you for food bank vouchers, or is it that kind of stuff you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the original principle, which is to simplify the benefit system, I think few would be able to argue with. I mean, anyone who's seen the Child Poverty Action Group's welfare handbook, it is literally like a Bible. It is, you know, small text and hundreds of pages long. But the way that it's been done and the assumptions that underpin that, I mean, the key kind of Ian Duncan Smith-ism that underpins universal credit is this idea that there are generations of workless people. And until Ian came along and told them there's this great thing called work, you know, they had no hope or a future. I mean, the biggest problem that I see and have always seen as an MP is the problem, in so much as you're trying to find a problem to address, is how people on, you know, low levels of income who are frequently going into and out of the labour market, either because the work is insecure in itself or they've got perhaps other caring responsibilities, maybe, you know, personal issues, health issues around drug and alcohol dependency, how you can have a system that responds to those different needs. And we use bureaucracy as a country to try and do that. I think that is a mistake. I think you can never really properly design a system that will cover the complexity of you know, everyone who will be claiming it. And you need simplicity, but you can't try and micromanage people's, you know, weekly comings and goings in terms of their income. And universal credit is flawed in its attempt to do that. It needs to be at a minimum slowed down. And the, you know, the transfer of people into universal credit, which unlike previous benefits, is going to be done by them. The government's not going to manage people to these new benefits. It's going to say, you've got to claim for universal credit by a deadline or you lose everything. And as soon as you claim, you're going to have to start the five-week process all over again. So there are huge problems with the rollout, but also with its design. But I mean, the question anyone will have now is, what would you cause in terms of the disruption to people to move everybody back to legacy benefits, many of which have been phased out in job centres up and down the country? But it certainly needs pausing whilst a proper plan is designed to go forward, because I don't think people quite realise that when we've, the problems we've seen so far have in the main been from new applicants to universal credit, and in the main, the relatively more straightforward cases, single people, you know, relatively young people. Once we start getting what the government's ambition is for 70,000 families a month directly transferred onto universal credit, if a small proportion of those go wrong, you can see the kind of stories that will generate.
My final question. The Chancellor, by tradition, is allowed to take any kind of drink that they want. It used to be an alcoholic drink. People seem to have, I think Gordon Brown was the first one to swear off that and took sparkling water. If you were Chancellor, what drink would you take?
I would definitely take whiskey. I think, you know, you've got to use your rights in Parliament as you find them. And if you're the Chancellor and you can bring in a bottle of whiskey, surely you've got to try and use that ability now and again.
Very nice. Thank you very much, Johnny Reynolds. And now for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
That was kind of slightly drill sergeant, John, but thank you for joining us.
That's my look.
That's what I've often said as I walked into the office. Wow, why is John dressed as a drill sergeant again? Stephen,
I don't like to talk about it.
You wrote a very nice piece about the latest episode of Doctor Who, Rosa. And so the question is Doctor Who better when it's classical and it just is a kids' programme?
So it's a family show, which throughout its life, kind of the pendulum of what age its writers are targeting kind of swings. And I do think it tends to be at its best when it is pitched at a 9 to 14 audience.
That's about your level, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's about my level.
Do you read YA?
I do occasionally, mostly on holidays. But I think then it works best in terms of its characters, its essential theme, when it is effectively pitched at a YA audience. Moffat's really good seasons, series 5, series 10, were very effectively pitched to that audience. ditto Russell's strongest seasons were pitched at pitched to that audience.
Helen, are you holding back the urge to say that you're the only one around the table who's actually met Russell?
Not anyway.
Because it looked like you wanted
met
to
Russell,
say that.
But actually Russell has made me several cups of tea. I brought him a load of hazelnut balls from Ottolenghi, which I then ate because we talked for like 3 hours. Because what I like about Russell T. Davis is he's got at all times maximum commitment to being Russell T. Davis. Like you get full RTD, like it's like a hairdryer in the face. It was amazing. I loved him as an interviewer.
Well, sticking with that theme, I met Stephen Moffat many years ago, nearly 20 years ago now, in a pub.
Yeah.
And he was...
Was he miserable?
He was quite rude to me, yeah. So, because I said to him, oh, I really like Press Gang, which is this sort of YA kind of style show he wrote about a school newspaper in the 90s. And he just went, oh, you're too young to know any better.
That's not rude, though. That's self-deprecating, which
yeah,
is different.
But it was, but the problem is because he was like a sort of growly Scottish man who'd had a few pints.
It came across
as rude.
I'll glass yeah. you.
I love the work of Steve Moffat. I think it is... I take your point that Doctor Who needs to sort of simplify occasionally and that some of the later seasons got a bit overly complex. But I think my problem with this new season is that the writing is not very good. And while it's kind of being pitched at that much simpler level, often that's kind of disguising the fact that some quite basic things are really not being thought through in any way.
I really like the work of Stephen Moffat. And at its best, Blink, for example, in Doctor Who terms, he is the finest writer of Doctor Who that there is. I also love, you know, have you read The Writer's Tale, the Russell T. Davis book? It is insane the hottest show on television and people were stealing the scripts. They worked through this incredible schedule where they were always like about to start filming and they still hadn't sorted the script out 2 days before. And RTD rewrote everyone incredibly heavily in a way that actually gave those seasons a lot more homogeneity, which I think is something maybe that's has changed since. But I think also both of them, fundamentally, I think it's very exposing to write a lot of TV, right? It kind of lays your psyche bare. So everything, there's a thread running through all of Stephen Moffat's work. And I love Coupling, one of my favourite sitcoms ever written. Jekyll is surprisingly good, but weird. But it turns out that, spoiler alert, what turns Jekyll from Hyde to Jekyll, Jekyll to Hyde, is women.
Yeah.
Because there's a sort of giant fear of like the eternal kind of dark feminine in all of that work.
It is all sexual politics. And I think also like there's not really a sort of obvious word for Moffat's take on this stuff because I don't think misogynist quite does it because he clearly like he massively admires clever women and
He works with his wife and his mother-in-law, right? So which is, I mean, maybe that's why maybe he's scared of women.
But there's something sort of essentialist about it. He does think there is some kind of fundamental difference between men and women. Like he may almost think women are better, but he does think there is kind of quite a clear divide there.
Yeah, whereas I think the work of Russell T. Davis is like a kind of, there's a certain essential Labradorness to it, actually. And the thing about Labradors is they knock a lot of stuff over, but you never really feel there's malice. I think it was one of the things I thought was really interesting about interviewing him was he said some really harsh things and kind of really slags off other TV programs. But his reputation is not at all like Mr. Bitter. Like it's because he's so gung-ho, full pelt, full, you know, burbling stream of joy. And that's what his episodes are.
Yeah, you get that also in his TV episodes as well. Like some of them are horrible. If you kind of think about the mechanics of what's actually happening.
Love and
screen,
Monsters.
Like, killing off like, you know, a tenth of the world's population in one episode. And that's the future of humanity have kind of come back in time to do that to themselves. And like,
someone has sex with
horrible.
A paving slab, John.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of steering away from that. The paving slab sex, which is now all anyone's thinking about.
But Chris,
this is
Chibnall,
great for the people who are listening who don't like Doctor Who and now also have paving slab sex. Are you
enjoying
this?
I think the difference is the New Statesman podcast.
Stop it, John.
I think the difference is crucially between the two is that the RTD era had very, very strong drawn out characters. Most Moffat characters are actually just archetypes, which is why many of the women characters feel like they're written in quite a sexist way because they are just an archetype. And the thing is in a strong Moffat era episode, that doesn't matter because the plot carries you through. But when the quality does dip, there's no kind of sort of backstop, as it were, of
family
of,
warmth,
yeah,
right? Which is what you get in Russell T. Davis.
So I think, yeah, the example to me is Time of the Doctor, right? Which actually has the same plot structure as Parting of the Ways. The Doctor is in a bad position. He can't escape. He knows he's going to die. So he sends the companion home so they'll be safe. And there are two crucial
Remind
difference.
Remind listeners which one that is.
So Time of the Doctor is the one where Matt Smith dies and turns into Peter Capaldi. Parting of the Ways part is where Christopher Eccleston keels over and turns into David Tennant. And there are a couple of crucial differences about why Parting of the Ways works and Time of the Doctor does not. The first, of course, is that
it's got when, Captain Jack in it.
Isn't when Rose is back home being sad and he's dying, we know who all of the characters are. They have names and personalities and characters. Whereas Clara's family, who I would defy anyone around this table to give an accurate description of who Clara's extant family members in any given season are, we've never met any of those people before. It has no weight because Clara has no character. Her character changes wildly in every different season she's in order to service the needs of being the companion to those stories at that time. And crucially, she has no agency in her returning to save him either, which means that as well as that being annoying from a gendered perspective, it means all of the scenes with her in Time of the Doctor drag because she's just sitting there having the plot.
Meeting the room.
Yeah, she's meeting the room.
I think it's much simpler than that. I think it's just Clara was rubbish.
But I think that's true of all.
She's played by quite an annoying actress and was there too long.
I feel like that about Martha.
All three of
We've
the companions.
We've all wiped out Martha from our minds.
In the Moffat era are actually just archetypes.
I think it works with Karen Gillan playing Amy because she kind of plays against the script. Like Amy is written as the same kind of, you know, Moffat female archetype too, which is kind of, you know, a bit gutsy and funny and snarky. They're all basically written the same, but like Karen Gillan plays her as, you know, completely mad. Like she just plays it as if she's insane and she doesn't worry about how it looks. And so I think that makes her much more interesting than when Jenna Louise Coleman plays Clara as she's in the page, which is very boring.
Can we talk about Chris Chibnall, the new showrunner and responsible for, well, John, your and my favourite ever Doctor Who Universe episode, Meat.
Alien Meat. I can't even do the Welsh accent.
It's got no bones in it.
This is a genuine problem. Every time Helen and I talk about Doctor Who, we do end up watching the trailer for the Tortured episode Meat, which is the greatest 30 seconds.
It's a huge space kebab.
In season two.
They're crying about a sausage.
I just can't believe you got that far into Torchwood.
I like Torchwood a lot. I liked it when little Owen became dead and then started vomiting up everything that he'd eaten. I thought that was great. Anyway, Chris Chibnall, a very different kind of writer again. Stephen, what do you think of his season so far?
Well, I mean, I've been pleasantly surprised by it because before the Chibnall era, Chibnall had basically written episodes which were either, in the case of the Silurian two-parter, just very dull, 42 very dull, or just a kind of eminently forgettable runaround like
Is the Silurian one the one where they... I think it was described by that great review site as basically one of the plot points is that there's cuddly Dr. Mengele, right? There's someone who's doing experiments on stuff in a bunker and we're supposed to nonetheless love them.
At first, he's this kind of horrific character, but later the Doctor says to him, you know, I kind of love you. And it's just clearly like the two halves of the script aren't talking to each other.
Uh-huh.
It looked like they just kind of changed the plot halfway through and didn't redraft the beginning.
Yeah, it has actually, I think, so far... I mean, admittedly, like the fascinating thing is this is now a show which has had three quite distinct eras in some ways, but actually the model RTD built when he rebooted the show of, you know, first episode in the present, second they go into the far future, then in the past, then spoiler alert, next episode they come back home and the bad thing has come to effectively remains unchanged by all of them. I think the big difference is that much to my surprise, the Chibnall era has been quite good.
I'm quite enjoying it. I have to say, I like it. I just think it was one of those things where, not to come back to me and my great time I had with RTD, but he did say about the people who objected to the Doctor being a woman, you know, get out of the light, just get out of the way. And I feel like the same kind of people who are slightly mourning the kind of end of the dark fairy tale of the Moffat era. There's loads of shows doing gritty. Actually doing big bouncy Labrador is harder, and there's not that many other shows that are whole family shows that are big BBC tea time ones. I'm all for it.
I mean, it's clearly working for people. The ratings are better than they've been in years. The reviews have been good. I just think there's a lot of stuff that they kind of haven't thought through. But, like, nothing as bad as the, you know, lizard Dr. Mengele thing, but there is stuff like, so the character of Yaz, so just takes her jacket off and then stops being a policeman. and they forget she doesn't act like a policeman after that. Like, at no point do they consider that
she's a police lady.
Thank you for that.
But yeah.
But like, there's just lots of stuff. So like in the second episode, where like we're told that the water's really horrible, it's going to kill people, and then it just isn't a factor. There's just lots of
that
stuff
was very
left.
Weird. That was like, and then there was absolutely no danger. You sort of thought they'd written that into an earlier draft, and then there was going to be a whole scene, and then actually what they did is got on a boat, and then they also had a bit of a nap. And then I thought, well, all the kind of mean bastards who are supposedly in this race for their lives are going to tip them off the boat into the water. That's what they're going to wake up. But instead, the young guy just woke up from a very refreshing sleep.
Yeah.
Nothing bad had happened.
I also like the fact that the monsters in that episode were evil scarves. I thought that was very cool.
Scarves are evil.
But the whole point scarves. Of that, of the water bit is its texture, thing. Right? It's basically we're in a big, scary world. Even the water's going to kill you. There's scary things in the dark. While basically fleshing out for new viewers, things like the doctor doesn't like guns, the doctor doesn't like violence. You have the two gritty space characters who are essentially like the worldview that the doctor supports, the worldview that the doctor opposes, right? I mean, this is like my big... Because I think the weird thing is, so obviously in a way, casting a woman as the doctor is quite radical, but in a more important sense, actually, in terms of the audience that matters to the show, i.e. people in that 9 to 14 bracket, anyone not called Peter Capaldi is radical casting. And the important thing of that kind of opening block of Meet the Companions, go into the future, is to reintroduce the Doctor to the audience. And I think the kind of scary planet does that quite well. I thought Art Malik was very satisfying. I think the interesting thing is, although I enjoyed Rosa a lot as an episode, as I kind of said in my article, historicals, I think, are probably my favourite genre of Doctor Who episode. And this was actually the only one which didn't wholly work for me, because the villain, whose job is effectively to be the contrivance, because they clearly still feel that you can't anymore have a solely historical adventure, never quite convinced and had that problem. I think a lot of humanoid opponents of the Doctor often have, but when they face off with them, it's just like, but you're not going to win, are you?
Also, he got zapped back in time. I mean, presumably to turn up later again, who knows? But that is pretty close to killing him if you put him anywhere outside of a very narrow band of time in which humans can survive on Earth. Quickly to wrap up, I want nominations for the best and worst things about Doctor Who in its current form. I'm going to say best thing. Sorry, I'm going to gazump you on this, John. Bradley Walsh.
He is really good.
Stunningly good.
It's really confusing.
And his pathos is upsetting and really nicely done. His timing is perfect. I like him as much as anyone since Catherine Tate, who was also another surprising older companion whom I loved. Worst thing is obviously that David Tennant is not my wife.
Okay, I'm going to broaden that. I think the cast is really good. It's an incredibly good cast, incredibly watchable. I will single out Tosin Cole's Ryan is very good. Worst thing is just the writing's a bit... I know it's only episode 3, but come on, give us something with meat on it.
Alien meat!
So I think the best thing is Whittaker, who I really immediately like as the Doctor. She's sort of pleasingly kind of weird and alien looking. Yeah, my problem is with the casting is when you have someone like Peter Davison or David Tennant, when they're kind of going, I'm an alien, it's like, are you? You're just a bit too much of a pretty boy. Like, but by the end, Tennant's kind of face grows into the role, but in that first season of Tennant, he just looks too much like an ordinary
bloke.
He's
always got alien teeth. He's always got great, like that great kind of thing he does with his teeth, where he really sticks his top teeth out.
Whereas she's got that kind of pleasing sort of Bern Gorman kind of Matt Smith like kind of like
what
angularness to her, then she kind of looks and just is more.
Have you been watching the wrong program? Jodie Whittaker doesn't look anything like Bern Gorman.
No, but
what
she's got an
about?
Angular thing, right? If you actually think about her face, John, actually think about it, not just in a kind of like, is one a woman, is one a man, but they've both got that kind of thing where you would never say that like Matt Smith or Bern Gorman is unattractive, but you also have a kind of like odd quality to them that means and they're slightly more believable as a kind of...
I sort of see what you mean, like, in that she's quite cheekbony.
Yeah.
But
David Tennant had really prominent cheekbones.
Yeah, but he's got more of a cartoon face rather than a granite face, right?
Yeah, in a kind of very attractive cheekbones way. There's just a quality. The thing I really do not like is the new TARDIS console. Doesn't have a proper time rotor. It's just weirdly dark. God. It doesn't look like someone lives there. I think that, yeah, like fundamentally the TARDIS both has to look like a cool spaceship and someone's home, and it needs to have a proper time rotor. That is not a proper time rotor.
Well, on that bombshell.
For more discussion of paving stone sex and vicious alien meat, why not tune into New Statesman After Dark?
Thank you, John. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is from the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not? Why not read some of my articles? Hey, just Google me. Just maybe send me a message. Say what you think about them, only if you like them. And now for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
No, that was too loud. That was way too loud. Sorry, it was like off the charts. Like,
can't
even hear it.
Okay, I'll do it back here.
Okay. Sorry, Caroline.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.